On this week's 51%, as more states legalize some form of marijuana, one woman has a message for other women.
This is big business, and that they should be diving in just as boldly as men in the industry have.
We'll hear about a female pinball wizard and a male midwife. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round.
According to Governing Magazine, 23 states and the District of Columbia currently have laws legalizing marijuana in some form. Four states and D.C. have legalized marijuana for recreational use, though D.C. prohibits the sale of pot. Alaska and Oregon are next after voter-approved ballot initiatives. Other states have legalized medical marijuana. Recreational and medical marijuana are legal in Colorado. And Jane West owns and operates a marijuana industry business there. She recently founded Women Grow, an organization intended to help women influence and succeed in the cannabis industry. Cannabis Radio Network's Brian Bayhuth recently spoke with West.
Can you describe the need to start a group like Women Grow?
There was a women's group in Colorado that had started the Women's Cannabis Business Network. And while it had excellent intentions, all the women in the network owned businesses. And it was something that they weren't able to volunteer their time to really invest in and organize. And so I just identified that all other major industries, technology and business and accounting and really almost every other field, has women's business networks, and so we should have one as well for the cannabis industry, to so that there is a portal to accept new female entrepreneurs and help onboard them, especially in the cannabis industry where there's so little information about how to get involved and to take. Would like to do is take the knowledge and experience of the women that do own successful cannabis businesses in Washington and Colorado and other states, that so that they can assist new female entrepreneurs and onboarding them as they bring their businesses on as the end of prohibition occurs on a national scale. And if we can have more women there at the beginning, there when the ballot initiative is put on, there when the legalization passes, decriminalization passes, then legalization passes, then if we can, they can be there at the very ground, then they'll have the most likely chance to have successful businesses as the cannabis industry takes hold in their individual states. And so we want to make sure that women, that the stigma of drug use or the cannabis industry that is very outdated and probably pretty prevalent in a lot of other states, doesn't prevent women from understanding that this is big business and that they should be diving in just as boldly as men in the industry have.
I'm curious, have you seen statistics on the number of women who own cannabis businesses?
I would love more statistics about this. It's one of the things that we're lacking. I hope that our group adds questions about demographics to their in-depth studies they do on an annual basis, because I would love more information about it. But I have observed that, especially at the C-level positions and in positions of power, they're disproportionately Caucasian men. It's interesting, as I've started doing this also, like, I meet photographers. Like, I'm working with a National Geographic photographer right now, and she says, well, it's the same thing in photography. As soon as they want a position out in, you know, in a war zone, I get bumped. And then I'm working with journalists that say, well, it's the same thing in journalism. So it's interesting how the more I talk about Women Grow and why it's important, how the women that I'm interacting with who are in other fields really confirm that they're still having issues in their particular industries as well.
Is there anything else about women grow or women owning businesses in the cannabis industry that I may not have asked you?
One of the reasons why, in my opinion, this has been so successful in Colorado is because of the community here. Because the group of individuals that I am not part of, I was not part of making legalization a reality in Colorado. I was not part of the movement. But the group of people that were very connected. And even though they disagreed, because there was a level of trust there, they compromised and worked together to make it a reality. And I think those face-to-face interactions and direct contact is what builds trust and what builds strong business relationships. And that's why we were able to make this successful in Colorado in such a short amount of time. And so I'm hoping that by connecting women face-to-face and having them foster those business relationships early on, that will not only help them be successful individually in the business industry, but also assist in pushing legalization efforts in their individual states, because the more we are able to work together, listen, and compromise as we write these laws in place, the more successful it will be.
Well, Jane West, I want to thank you so much for taking time to chat with Cannabis Radio News.
No problem. Thank you so much for having me. Anytime.
Next, we travel to California, to another sphere where women are few. Angela Johnston for KALW tells us about a women's pinball league that gives a positive tilt to the Bay Area scene.
Ellen Frankel slips the last of her quarters into the Medieval Madness pinball machine and wipes the sweat off her forehead. It's her second game of the night, and she's trying to get a new high score. And although she is shy to admit it, Frankel is a real pinball wizard.
I kind of do have a pinball claim to fame, yes. I was female world champion in 1994, and so I was top 10 in the world at one point.
She's the only woman who has ever won a national pinball championship. And tonight, she's joined by a dozen other women at the High Life Bar in Oakland. They're all members of Bells and Chimes, a women's only pinball league.
Everybody knows that they have this one thing in common, and it's just kind of like a starting point to forge actually new friendships and also have a little bit of fun at the same time.
All right, so let's play pinball.
The league started a year ago when Eka Schneider, who's a nationally ranked pinball player herself, noticed that she was just about the only woman to show up at tournaments.
I thought it would be a nice way to encourage more women to get into pinball if I had a women-only league.
So she founded Bells and Chimes. Schneider tells me that pinball's gender issues run deeper than the images of bikini-clad women plastered over many of the machines.
Boobs, boobs, boobs. There's just boobs all over pinball machines, all of them.
Or the sexist notion of rescuing damsels in distress.
No, I have a headache.
It's about access. The top 25 players in the world, according to the International Flipper Pinball Association, are all men. At a national competition last fall that attracted 400 players, Schneider said fewer than 40 women competed. Two of them were members of Bells and Chimes. And for female pinball players in the Bay Area, the male-dominated pastime isn't always the most welcoming.
It can be pretty intimidating to walk into a room full of like 60 dudes and you're the only girl and you don't know anybody.
Not to mention the assumptions that exist before you even walk in the room.
That women don't know what they're doing. Like, I am not like the greatest pinball player in the world, but I'm quite good at pinball. And when I'm playing on location, I am constantly having men approach me and like try to tell me really basic things about how to play pinball. But there's just always this assumption that you don't know what you're doing.
So at Bells and Chimes, Schneider tries to create an environment that stresses fun over top scores.
I am Sally, and I want Goldwing's soundtrack to be like the soundtrack of my life.
And when someone does well, everyone celebrates.
It's good just to, I think, have more women playing and being visible about playing.
The league's success has even led to the opening of a second chapter in New York City.
There's definitely, in the past year or two, I've seen so many more women at tournaments and competitive events. So women in pinball are becoming a lot more visible than they have been in the past.
Back at the Medieval Madness game, Ellen Frankel has already racked up millions of points. She's knocked down castles, rescued princesses, and fought off a pack of trolls. That cracking sound means Frankel had a solid game. She scored enough points to get a replay or a free game. In fact, she got way more than she needed. Her final score is 62 million.
Did you just get the second highest score for that game?
Well, it's a new game in here, so it's, yeah, for now. For now, yes, it's the second, but it won't last long, I promise.
For Frankel, the score is just another number. What's more important is the feeling she gets from playing.
Each pinball game is different. It's not just each machine being different. Every game that you play is different. It's controlled carom in a way. It's lovely.
And she says to be playing with a group of women that all feel the same way, it's even better than winning.
Scoops again!
In Oakland, I'm Angela Johnston for Cross Currents.
Often we bring you stories of women in predominantly male fields. Well, let's mix it up a bit and hear about the reverse. Men in an overwhelmingly female field. It was in 1982 when men were allowed to become midwives in France. Midwives train for 5 years and are present at each hospital birth. They care for women during pregnancy and birth and can provide birth control and gynecological health care. Yet they do not have the same status as obstetricians or gynecologists. Sarah Elzis meets one of the rare men in this field today. He says the gender imbalance of his profession has led to its marginalization.
Nicolas Dutriot is hypnotizing his first patient of the day. On her second pregnancy, the patient is anxious. She's suffering from panic attacks, and hypnosis helps calm her down. His second patient comes in with her 3-month-old baby. Nicolas talks her through exercises to strengthen her pelvic muscles stretched out after giving birth. From hypnosis to postpartum exercises, delivering babies and birth control, this is the work of a midwife. The job touches on everything, he says. It can be medical, involve anesthesia, intensive care in the birthing clinic. It crosses over into other professions too, he says, psychology, sociology. He wasn't familiar with midwifery until he redid his first year of medical school and was drawn to the idea of working across disciplines. And there's work to do. Midwives are present at every birth in French hospitals. Despite this, though, Nicolas calls it an invisible profession. Midwives are not recognized as primary caregivers, and he says it's in part due to the fact that it's a profession dominated by women. 98% of midwives in France are women, he says, as are 100% of their patients. Until 1982, the profession wasn't even open to men. Nicolas points to a historical power differential in the French medical system. There's a split between the medical and support staff that's very French, he says, and doctors are on top of the hierarchy. There's the doctor and then everyone else. Traditionally, 100% of doctors were men, he said, and 100% of midwives were women, and one took the lead. We know which one that was. At midday, he leaves his office, gets into the car to visit two new mothers at their homes. He's very aware of the gender stereotypes in his profession. He remembers being an intern in a hospital. He'd enter a room and his patients would say, "Hold on, the doctor's here," even though he was wearing a pink nurse's uniform. But when his female colleagues would come in with the same uniform, they'd immediately be identified as a midwife. He says that this perception, not only by patients but by doctors and other hospital staff, has put the profession on an unequal footing. He's been part of a nationwide strike over the past year that's asking for more recognition of the midwife profession. We're some of the best trained midwives in the world, he says, of France, and yet we're limited in what we're allowed to do by some gynecologists and doctors who consider us as competition. The strike action has not been very successful, partly because as medical staff they can't actually stop work very long. Nicolas muses on the future of his profession. If it evolves to have more responsibilities, would it attract more men? Eventually, yes, he says. He rings the doorbell on an apartment in a housing project. Isabelle answers the door. She gave birth 4 days earlier to her fourth child, a girl. Nicolas undresses the baby to weigh her on a portable scale he's brought with him. After weighing the baby, he helps Isabelle with breastfeeding. Isabelle is not shy around him, but Nicolas says the choice of a male or female midwife is personal. Some women will only go to male gynecologists, others only to female ones, he says. It's the same for midwives. It's a personal choice.
Au revoir, bonne journée. À demain.
On the way out, on the way to another home visit, Nicolas reflects on his choice of profession. Why not choose a job that's paid more, has fewer constraints? Well, there's something of a mission to it, he says, getting into the lift. I get to care for healthy people, he says, to make sure they stay that way. It's just as interesting as treating sick people. And if you can keep them from getting sick, even better. For Radio France International, I'm Sarah Elzis in Herblay, north of Paris.
Sarah Elzis produced this report for Radio France International. Imagine coming home from school and finding your mom passed out, surrounded by empty liquor bottles. For Louise Farraher, that was the everyday reality of her childhood in County Mayo, Ireland. She grew up detoxing her mother and looking after her younger siblings. Alan Meany reports.
I just wanted to meet you and see how you're getting on with college and getting to the mature student thing.
Grand, good now. Just filling out paperwork forms and doing my best to, you know.
Louise Farraher is applying to become a nurse, and at 24 she already has a lot of experience. Louise grew up near Castlebar in County Mayo in the Irish Republic, one of four children, three girls and one boy, brought up by her mum Valerie. A loving, caring family. Only the image covered up her problem. As Louise recalls, her mum was a serious alcoholic for much of her childhood.
I was about 10 when it all kind of started to go a little bit sour, a bit south. We went through an awful lot of rehabs. I grew up a lot faster than I wanted to. We had to look after ourselves an awful lot, you know, just thinking about other people before thinking of yourself.
Her mum Val would leave discarded vodka bottles all around the house and often disappear for hours at a time, with the girls left searching the local towns and villages. Now recovered, she says it was Louise's help which saw her through some of the worst times.
From being a very, very young girl, she was providing detoxes. My husband obviously had to go to work, so whenever I was given Librium by my GP, it needed to be monitored and minded. And of course, Louise was the one that was always asked to stay at home from school, simply because she was the calmest of all the children. She would read the instructions on the bottle. I would spend a few days in bed while she would take over the house and be detoxing her mother, which isn't an easy job.
What was it like when you were trying to take care of things and your mum was going off the rails?
Hectic. My gosh, it was chaos. We were all in school, all under the age of 18. So we were teenagers. And, you know, of course, we're all arguing with each other. And I always said that if I was to get into my nursing, I'd love to go into A&E because I love mess.
And it's those stark, dark experiences as a child which prompted Louise, with the help of her mum, to launch a special service called New Choices. The organisation provides practical and moral support for other families blighted by alcoholism across Ireland.
Hey, how are you? Come on in.
There's no judgment. We're very, very person-centered. Yeah, we want what's best for you. We're not going to make you fill out paperwork after paperwork after paperwork. We're going to be there for you, to listen to you, to help you through your problem.
And while her mum can understand what the women addicted to drink are going through, Louise's own experience means she can empathise with the children in the families she now works with.
With us, it was, you know, I needed my older sisters. You know, we needed to talk to each other. How we're going to get through this. You do need your family to get involved in it because you're a unit.
The support provided by Louise and her mum is provided in the home and is confidential. Many mothers in Ireland are scared of the authorities finding out about their addiction for fear their children will be taken away from them. Lachlan Scott is a research psychologist who works with Louise.
In the home environment, if you get treatment in the home environment, it has been shown that it's got a longer lasting effect. There are better outcomes because you work in the place where, say, there are these things called triggers. Triggers are something that will offset a person to start drinking again, start doing drugs or get violent. And if you can identify these triggers within the home environment and work on them in the home environment, you get better outcomes.
And Lachlan says Louise's personal story is inspiring.
I think it's amazing to see how far Louise has come from being through a situation like that, because it's very easy to go one way or the other when you're dealing with a problem, an addiction in the home or a problem in the home as a young teenager or as a young child.
Meanwhile, Val sees big things ahead for her daughter.
I don't think she even realises the impact she has on her friends around her, on the families that we meet, on the children that she cares for. I see Louise making huge changes in Ireland. And, you know, somebody has to do it. But I know that she gets so frustrated and it's, I'm going to the doll with this, you know, and I'll make changes and this isn't going to happen to any other family. So she's fire in her belly and a brain in her head.
The service provided by Louise and her mum is currently largely focused on the north and west of the Republic. They hope to eventually expand their support work to help families all over Ireland. This is Alan Meaney for DW in County Mayo, Ireland.
Members of the 114th Congress were sworn in January 6th, and Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi says it was an historic swearing-in of 65 House Democratic women, the largest number of women in a party caucus in the history of the Congress of the United States. The same day was historic for GOP women, when Mia Love of Utah became the first black female Republican in Congress. Love, the 39-year-old former mayor of Saratoga Springs, Utah, was sworn in along with 57 other freshmen in the U.S. House. Her history-making election in November in Utah's 4th District drew national attention and helped secure Love's status as a standout among the incoming GOP lawmakers. She is part of a small group of black Republicans in the new Congress. Love is also becoming a member of the Congressional Black Caucus. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1330.